rebellion. I wonder what other minutiae, personal vices, and petty crimes are occupying the National Guard's time, and where they're occupying it. Until we get this sorted out, better not jaywalk. There could be a military helicopter overhead. Police have justified this sort of heavy-handedness by claiming that people who run illegal gambling operations tend to be armed, a blanket characterization that absurdly lumps neighborhood hold'em tournaments with Uncle Junior Soprano's weekly poker game. And in any case, if police know that people inside an establishment are likely to be armed, it makes even less sense to come in with guns blazing. Police have also defended the paramilitary tactics by noting that poker games are usually flush with cash and thus tend to get robbed. That, too, is an absurd argument, unless the police are afraid they're going to raid a game at precisely the same moment it's getting robbed. Under either scenario, the police are acknowledging that the people playing poker when these raids go down have good reason to think that the men storming the place with guns may be criminals, not cops. Indeed, that's exactly what happened to 72-year-old Aaron Autry in 2010. Autry was hosting a poker tournament in his Greenville, South Carolina home when police began breaking down the door with a battering ram. Autry had begun carrying a gun after being robbed. Thinking he was about to be robbed again, he fired through the door, wounding Deputy Matthew May in both arms. The other officers opened fire into the building. Miraculously, only Autry was hit. As he fell back into the hallway, other players reported him asking, "Why didn't you tell me it was the cops?" The raid team claimed they knocked and announced several times before putting ram to door, but other players said they heard no knock or announcement. When Autry recovered, he was charged with attempted murder. As part of an agreement, he pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Police had broken up Autry's games in the past, but on those occasions, they had knocked and waited. He had let them in peacefully, and he'd been given a $100 fine. The poker raids have gotten bad enough that the Poker Players Alliance, an interest group that lobbies to make the game legal, has established a network of attorneys around the country to help players who have been raided and arrested. But the mission creep hasn't stopped at poker games. By the end of the 2000s, police departments were sending SWAT teams to enforce regulatory law. In August 2010, for example, a team of heavily armed Orange County, Florida sheriff's deputies raided several black and Hispanic-owned barbershops in the Orlando area. More raids followed in September and October. The Orlando Sentinel reported that police held barbers and customers at gunpoint and put some in handcuffs, while they turned the shops inside out. The police raided a total of 9 shops and arrested 37 people. By all appearances, these raids were drug sweeps. Shop owners told the Sentinel that police asked them where they were hiding illegal drugs and weapons. But in the end, 34 of the 37 arrests were for barbering without a license, a misdemeanor for which only 3 people have ever served jail time in Florida. The most disturbing aspect of the Orlando raids was that police didn't even attempt to obtain a legal search warrant. They didn't need to, because they conducted the raids in conjunction with the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation. Despite the guns and handcuffs, under Florida law, these were licensure inspections, not criminal searches, so no warrants were necessary. That such administrative searches have become an increasingly common way for police to get around the Fourth Amendment is bad enough. More disturbing is the amount of force they're opting to use when they do. In the fall of 2010, police in New Haven, Connecticut, sent a SWAT team to a local bar to investigate reports of underage drinking. Patrons were lined up at gunpoint while cops confiscated cell phones and checked IDs. There have been similar underage drinking SWAT raids on college fraternities. The Atlanta City Council recently agreed to pay a $1 million settlement to the customers and employees of a gay nightclub after a heavy-handed police raid in which police lined up 62 people on the floor at gunpoint, searched for drugs, and checked for outstanding warrants and unpaid parking tickets. Police conducted the September 2009 raid after undercover vice cops claimed to have witnessed patrons and employees openly having sex at the club. But the police never obtained a search warrant. Instead, the raid was conducted under the guise of an alcohol inspection. Police made no drug arrests, but arrested 8 employees for permit violations. Federal appeals courts have upheld these administrative searches even when it seems obvious that the real intent was to look for criminal activity, as long as the government can plausibly claim that the primary purpose of the search was regulatory. In the case of the Orlando raids, simply noting the arrests of 34 unlicensed barbers would be enough to meet the test. But the Fourth Amendment requires that searches be reasonable. If using a SWAT team to make sure a bar isn't serving 19-year-olds is a reasonable use of force, it's hard to imagine what wouldn't be. At least a couple of federal appeals courts have recognized the absurdity. In 2009, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit struck a small blow for common sense, allowing a civil rights suit to go forward against the Sheriff's Department of Rapides Parish, Louisiana, after a warrantless SWAT raid on a nightclub thinly veiled as an administrative search. And in 1995, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit made an even broader ruling, finding that having probable cause and a warrant for the arrest of one person in a club did not justify a SWAT raid and subsequent search of the entire club and everyone inside. But other legal challenges to paramilitary-style administrative searches have been less successful. Consider the bizarre case of David Ruttenberg, owner of the Rack and Roll Pool Hall in Manassas Park, Virginia. In June 2004, local police conducted a massive raid on the pool hall with more than 50 police officers, some of whom were wearing face masks, toting semi-automatic weapons, and pumping shotguns as they entered. Customers were detained, searched, and zip-tied. The police were investigating Ruttenberg for several alleged drug crimes, although he was never charged. The local narcotics task force had tried unsuccessfully to get a warrant to search Ruttenberg's office, but were denied by a judge. Instead, they simply brought along several representatives of the Virginia Department of Alcohol Beverage Control and claimed that they were conducting an alcohol inspection. Ruttenberg was cited only for 3 alcohol violations, based on 2 bottles of beer a distributor had left that weren't clearly marked as samples, and a bottle of vodka they found in his private office. In June 2006, Ruttenberg filed a civil rights suit alleging that, among other things, using a SWAT team to conduct an alcohol inspection was an unreasonable use of force. The town's vendetta against Ruttenberg stretched on for years and is one of the strangest cases I've ever encountered. He eventually sold his bar and moved to New York. In 2010, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit denied his claim. So for now, in the Fourth Circuit, sending a SWAT team to make sure a bar's beer is labeled correctly is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. By the end of the decade, state and local SWAT teams were regularly being used not only for raids on poker games and gambling operations, but also for immigration raids on both businesses and private homes, and raids on massage parlors, cat houses, and unlicensed strip clubs. Today, the sorts of offenses that can subject a citizen to the SWAT treatment defy caricature. If the government wants to make an example of you by pounding you with a wholly disproportionate use of force, it can. It's rare that courts or politicians even object, much less impose consequences. Another example is the use of these tactics on people suspected of downloading child pornography. Because people suspected of such crimes are generally considered among the lowest of the low, there's generally little objection to using maximum force to apprehend them. But when police use force to demonstrate disgust for the crimes the target is suspected of committing, there's always a risk of letting disgust trump good judgment. In one recent case in West Virginia, police violently stormed a house after a Walmart employee reported seeing an image of a man's genitals near a child's cheek in a set of photos a customer had left at the store to be developed. After terrorizing the customer's family, he was out of town. The police learned that the cheek in the photo wasn't a child, but that of a 35-year-old Filipino woman. Given that most child pornography investigations today involve people who use the internet to find or distribute the offending images and videos, the investigations can be fraught with problems. There have been several instances in recent years of police waging child porn raids on people after tracing IP addresses, only to learn after the fact that the victims of the raid had an open wireless router that someone else had used to download the pornography. Inevitably, the lesson drawn by police and by the media covering these stories is not that a SWAT raid may be an inappropriate way to arrest someone suspected of looking at child porn on a computer, or that police who insist on using such tactics should probably factor the possibility of an open router into their investigation before breaking down someone's door, but rather that we should all make sure our wireless routers are password protected, so we don't get wrongly raided by a SWAT team too. It can also be difficult to trace an IP address to a physical address, which can lead to yet more mistaken raids. An example of that problem manifested in one of the most bizarre botched raids in recent years. It took place in September 2006, when a SWAT team from the Bedford County Sheriff's Department stormed the rural Virginia home of A.J. Knuckles, his wife, and their two children. Police had traced the IP address of someone trading child porn online to the Knuckles' physical address. They had made a mistake. As if the shock of having his house invaded by a SWAT team wasn't enough, Knuckles was in for another surprise. In a letter to the editor of the Chatham Star Review, he described the raid. "Men ran at me, dropped into shooting position, double-handed semi-automatic pistols pointed at me, and made me put my hands against my truck. I was held at gunpoint, searched, taunted, and led into the house. I had no idea what this was about. I was scared beyond description." He then looked up and saw former NBA star Shaquille O'Neal. O'Neal, an aspiring lawman, had been made an honorary deputy with the department. Though he had no training as a SWAT officer, Shaq apparently had gone on several such raids with other police departments around the country. The thrill of bringing an untrained celebrity along apparently trumped the requirement that SWAT teams be staffed only with the most elite, most highly qualified, and best-trained cops. According to Knuckles, O'Neal reached into Knuckles' pickup, snatched up his perfectly legal rifle, and exclaimed, "We've got a gun!" O'Neal told Time that Knuckles' description of the raid on his home was exaggerated. "It ain't no story," he said. "We did everything right, went to the judge, got a warrant. You know, they make it seem like we beat him up. And that never happened. We went in, talked to him, took some stuff, returned it, bada bam, bada bing." Incidentally, there have been other strange incidents of SWAT teams with star power. Matt Damon accompanied SWAT officers on several raids while preparing for the movie The Departed. And after police mistakenly shot and killed immigrant and father Ismail Mena on a raid in Denver in 1999, they revealed that Colorado Rockies first baseman Mike Lansing had gone along for the ride. Denver police added that it was fairly common to take sports stars on drug raids. In 2010, a massive Maricopa County SWAT team, including a tank and several armored vehicles, raided the home of Jesus Llovera. The tank, in fact, drove straight into Llovera's living room. Driving the tank, action movie star Steven Seagal, whom Sheriff Joe Arpaio had recently deputized. Seagal had also been putting on the camouflage to help Arpaio with his controversial immigration raids. All of this, by the way, was getting caught on film. Seagal's adventures in Maricopa County would make up the next season of the A&E TV series Steven Seagal, Lawman. Llovera's suspected crime? Cockfighting. Critics said that Arpaio and Seagal brought an army to arrest a man suspected of fighting chickens to play for the cameras. Seagal's explanation for the show of force: "Animal cruelty is one of my pet peeves." All of Llovera's chickens were euthanized. During the raid, the police also killed his dog. In the end, while the Supreme Court has laid down some avoidable requirements for obtaining a no-knock warrant or deciding to conduct a no-knock raid at the scene, there are few court decisions, laws, or regulations when it comes to when it is and isn't appropriate to use a SWAT team and all the bells and whistles of a dynamic entry. The decision is almost always left to the discretion of the police agency, or in the case of the multi-jurisdictional task forces, to the SWAT team itself. The mere fact that there's actually a split in the federal court system over the appropriateness of using SWAT teams to perform regulatory alcohol inspections at bars shows just how little attention the courts pay to the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness requirement. In other words, if the DEA wants to stick it to medical marijuana users because they're flouting federal law, they can. If Steven Seagal wants to drive a tank into a man's living room to demonstrate his love of animals, he can. If the Consumer Products Safety Commission, CPSC, wants to send a SWAT team to a physicist's house to show that it's cracking down on illegal bottle rockets, it can. At worst, the DEA, the CPSC, and Steven Seagal will be chastised by a judge after the fact, though that seldom happens. Even on the rare occasions when someone actually gets into court and wins an excessive force lawsuit stemming from a raid, the damages are usually borne by taxpayers, not by the cops who used excessive force. In some cases, community outrage and bad press have persuaded police agencies to change a policy here or there regarding the deployment of their SWAT teams. But if they want to renege and go back to breaking down the doors of people suspected of stealing decorative fish, there's very little to stop them. Toward the end of the 2000s, there were hints that the public was beginning to want a change, though that desire could manifest in unexpected ways. A former colleague at the Cato Institute, Tim Lynch, has told me that when he gives talks about the Waco raid, he finds that people are somewhat sympathetic to the argument that the government overreacted, but that they still can't get past the weirdness of the Branch Davidians themselves, their stockpile of weapons, and the claims of sexual abuse and drug distribution in the community. Even the children who died are sometimes dismissed with guilt by association. But when he mentions that the ATF agents killed the Davidians' dogs, Lynch tells me, people become visibly angry. I have found the same thing to be true in my reporting on drug raids. At first, that may seem to indicate that people callously value the lives of pets more than the lives of people. But the fact that killing the dog during these raids has become nearly routine in many police agencies demonstrates just how casually those agencies have come to accept drug war collateral damage. When I started logging cop shoots dog incidents on my blog, under the probably sensational term puppy side, people began sending me news stories as they happened. Cops are now shooting dogs at the slightest provocation. As of this writing, I'm sent accounts of a few incidents each week. It's difficult to say if this is happening more frequently. There are no national figures, and estimates are all over the map. One dog handler recently hired to train a police department in Texas estimates there are up to 250,000 cop shoots dog cases each year. That seems high. In 2009, Randall Lockwood of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, ASPCA, told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that he sees 250 to 300 incidents per year in media reports, and he estimates that another 1,000 aren't reported. The Indianapolis Star reported that between 2000 and 2002, police in that city shot 44 dogs. A recent lawsuit filed by the Milwaukee owner of a dog killed by cops found that police in that city killed 434 dogs over a 9-year period, or about one every 7.5 days. But those figures aren't all that helpful. They don't say how many of those dogs were actually vicious, how many were strays, or how many were injured and perhaps killed as an act of mercy, versus how many were unjustified killings of pets. What is clear is that police are almost always cleared of any wrongdoing in these shootings. An officer's word that he felt a dog posed a threat to his safety is generally all it takes. Whether or not the officer's fear was legitimate doesn't seem to matter. Thanks to smartphones and surveillance cameras, a growing batch of these incidents caught on video have shown that officers' claims that the dog was threatening often aren't matched by the dog's body language. In recent years, police officers have shot and killed Chihuahuas, Golden Retrievers, Labs, Miniature Dachshunds, Wheaton Terriers, and Jack Russell Terriers. In 2012, a California police officer shot and killed a boxer puppy and pregnant Chihuahua, claiming the boxer had threatened him. The Chihuahua, he said, got caught in the crossfire. Police officers have also recently shot dogs that were chained, tied, or leashed, going so far as to kill pets while merely questioning neighbors about a crime in the area, cutting across private property while in pursuit of a suspect, and after responding to false burglar alarms. It's possible that these incidents could just be attributed to rogue cops, but the fact that the police are nearly always excused in these cases, even in the more ridiculous examples, suggests there may be an institutional problem. So does the fact that only a handful of police departments give their cops any training at all when it comes to reading and handling the dogs they may encounter. In a 2012 article for the Huffington Post, my intern, J.L. Green, and I looked at 24 recent cases of puppycide and called the relevant police departments to inquire about training. Only one department could confirm that its officers received training at the time of the incident in question. 11 departments did not return our phone calls. That jibes with an earlier article I wrote for the Daily Beast, in which both the ASPCA and the Humane Society told me that they offer such training to any police department that wants it, while few take advantage of the offer. Joseph Pentangelo, the ASPCA's Assistant Director for Law Enforcement, who also served 21 years with the NYPD, told me, "New York is the only state I know of that mandates formalized training, and that's during academy. There are some individual departments in other parts of the country that avail themselves of our training, but not many, not enough." Given how likely it is that police officers will often interact with animals, you would think that such training would be common. It is at the U.S. Postal Service. A spokesman for the USPS told me that while dog bites do happen on occasion, serious dog attacks on mail carriers are almost non-existent. Postal workers are given regular training in distracting dogs with toys, subduing them with voice commands, or, at worst, incapacitating them with mace. Mail carriers are shown a 2-hour video and then given annual instruction on topics like recognizing and reading a dog's body language and differentiating between aggressive charging and playful bounding, and between a truly dangerous dog and a merely territorial one. The fact that the Postal Service offers such training, and most police departments don't, lends some credence to the theory that dog shootings are part of the larger problem of a battlefield mentality that lets police use lethal force in response to the slightest threat, usually with few consequences. "It's an evolving phenomenon," says Norm Stamper, the former Seattle police chief. "It started when drug dealers began to recruit pit bulls to guard their supply. These dogs weren't meant to attack cops. They were meant to attack other drug dealers who came to rob them. But of course they did attack cops. And yes, that's awfully scary if one of those things latches onto your leg." But Stamper says that, like many aspects of modern policing, dog shootings may have had a legitimate origin, but the practice has since become a symptom of the mindset behind a militarized police culture. Among other things, it really shows a lack of imagination. These guys think that the only solution to a dog that's yapping or charging is shooting and killing it. That's all they know. It goes with this notion that police officers have to control every situation, to control all the variables. That's an awesome responsibility, and if you take it on, you're caving to delusion. You no longer exercise discrimination or discretion. You have to control, and the way you control is with authority, power, and force. With a dog, the easiest way to take control is to simply kill it. I mean, especially if there are no consequences for doing so. A handful of police departments do now mandate dog training, including Nashville, Omaha, and Milwaukee. Police departments in Austin, Fort Worth, and Arlington, Texas do too. All began offering training after public backlash over one or more cop shoots dog incidents. "In my 10 years in law enforcement on the street, I can't remember one case where a police officer shot a dog," says Russ Jones, the former narcotics cop with the San Jose Police Department and the DEA. "I don't understand it at all." I guess, somewhere along the line, a cop shot a dog under questionable circumstances and got away with it. Word got out, and now it seems like some cops are just looking for reasons to take a shot at a dog. Maybe it just comes down to that. We can get away with it. Therefore, we do it. On the Friday afternoon before the 2009 G20 summit was to begin in Pittsburgh at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, a reader in the city sent me a photo he'd snapped moments earlier. The photo was of a police officer standing in the middle of an intersection. He was wearing a military green top, camouflage pants, and combat boots. He had a gun strapped to his thigh and looked to be carrying another one. The camouflage in particular seemed odd, as it does whenever it's worn by a police officer in an urban area. It was unclear why this cop would have wanted to hide, and even if he did, how camouflage would help him to do so in the city. There seemed to be little purpose for it, other than to mimic the military. In any case, it was a sign of what was to come. This is how the country that gave the world the First Amendment now handles protest. There's a disquieting ease now with which authorities are willing to crush dissent, and at the very sorts of events where the right to dissent is the entire purpose of protecting free speech. That is, events where influential policymakers meet to make high-level decisions with far-reaching consequences. In fact, the more important the policymakers and the more consequential the decisions they'll be making, the more likely it is that police will use more force to keep protesters as far away as possible. As Norm Stamper said, this, unfortunately, was the lesson the country's law enforcement agencies took from the 1999 WTO protests in Seattle. A number of police departments from across the country had sent officers to Pittsburgh to help police the 2009 summit. Nearly all were dressed in similar paramilitary garb. In one widely circulated video from the summit, several police officers dressed entirely in camouflage emerged from an unmarked car, apprehended a young backpack-toting protester, stuffed him into the car, then drove off. It evoked the sort of disappearance you might envision happening in a Latin American country headed by a junta, or one of the countries of the Soviet bloc. Matt Drudge linked to the video with a headline describing the officers in it as members of the military. They weren't, though it's certainly easy to understand how someone might make that mistake. Another video showed a police unit with a handcuffed protester. Officers surrounded the protester, propped him up, then posed with him while another officer snapped a trophy photo. YouTube later removed the video, citing a terms of use violation. It was later revealed that the police unit was from Chicago. They had taken vacation time to come to Pittsburgh to provide freelance security for the G20 summit. As the summit went on, Twitter feeds and uploaded photos and videos claimed, and sometimes provided some evidence to prove, that police fired tear gas canisters into dorm rooms, used sound cannons, and fired beanbags and rubber bullets. One man was arrested for posting the locations of riot police to his Twitter feed. The charges were later dropped. Emily Tanner, a grad student at the University of Pittsburgh, who described herself as a capitalist who didn't agree with the general philosophy of the anti-globalization protesters, covered the summit, the protests, and the fallout on her blog. The most egregious police actions seemed to take place on the Friday evening before the summit around the university, when police began ordering students who were in public spaces to disperse, despite the fact that they had broken no laws. Students who moved too slowly were arrested, as were students who were standing in front of the dormitories where they lived. A University of Pittsburgh spokesman later said that the tactic was to break up crowds that had the potential of disrupting normal activities, traffic flow, egress, and the like. Much of the arrests last night had to do with failure to disperse when ordered. Note that no one needed to have broken any actual laws to get arrested. The potential to break a law was more than enough. That standard was essentially a license for the police to arrest anyone, anywhere in the city, at any time, for any reason. Pennsylvania ACLU legal director Vic Welchak said the problem was that police didn't bother to attempt to manage the protests. They simply suppressed them. In the process, they rounded up not only innocent protesters, but innocent students who had nothing to do with the protests at all. In all, 190 people were arrested. One of the arrestees was a reporter from the left-leaning organization Indie Media. When they apprehended her, the police took her camera. When they returned her camera, it was broken, and the police had deleted her photos and videos of the protests and police reaction. The police presence seemed to focus almost exclusively on peaceful demonstrators, Walchak said. On Friday night, they didn't even have the excuse of property damage going on or any illegal activity. It's really inexplicable. Inexcusable, perhaps, but not inexplicable. Since Seattle, this had become the template. At the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, police conducted peremptory raids on the homes of protesters before the convention had even started. Police broke into the homes of people known to be activist rabble-rousers before they had any evidence of any actual crime. Journalists who inquired about the legitimacy of the raids and arrests made during the convention were also arrested. In all, 672 people were put in handcuffs. The arrest of Democracy Now! Journalist Amy Goodman was captured on a widely viewed video. She was charged with conspiracy to riot. That charge against Goodman was later dropped. So were the charges against most of the others arrested. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reported the following February that charges were dropped or dismissed for 442 of the 672 people arrested. There were similar problems at the 2008 Democratic National Convention. Police in Denver showed up for the protests decked out in full riot gear. One particularly striking photo from Denver showed a sea of cops in shiny black armor, batons in hand, surrounding a small, vastly outnumbered group of protesters. The most volatile night of the convention featured one incident in which Jefferson County, Colorado deputies unknowingly clashed with and then pepper-sprayed undercover Denver cops posing as violent protesters. The city later paid out $200,000 to settle a lawsuit alleging that a Denver SWAT team was making indiscriminate arrests, rounding up protesters and bystanders alike. Perhaps the best insight into the mentality the police brought to the DNC protests could be found on the T-shirts the Denver Police Union had printed up for the event. The shirts showed a menacing cop holding a baton. The caption, DNC 2008, we get up early to beat the crowds. Police were spotted wearing similar shirts at the 2012 NATO summit in Chicago. At the 1996 DNC convention in Chicago, cops were seen wearing shirts that read, We kicked your father's ass in 1968. Wait till you see what we do to you. This default militaristic response to protest of overkill was then given an extended national stage during the Occupy protests of 2011. In the most infamous incident, now forever captured in countless internet memes and mashups, Lieutenant John Pike of the University of California Davis campus police casually hosed down a peaceful group of protesters with a pepper spray canister. But that was far from the only incident. Police across the country met protesters in riot gear, once again anticipating, and in too many instances seemingly even craving, confrontation. In Oakland, the skull of Iraq War veteran Scott Olson was fractured by a tear gas canister that the police had fired into the crowd. In New York, NYPD officer Anthony Bologna pepper sprayed a group of helpless protesters who had been penned in by police fencing. One thing the Occupy crackdowns did seem to do was focus renewed attention on police tactics and police militarization. Big picture stories about the Pentagon buildup, Department of Homeland Security, DHS funding for anti-terror gear, and the proliferation of SWAT teams started streaming out of media outlets, giving the militarization issue the most coverage it had received since Kraska's studies came out in the late 1990s. Part of that was due to social media, the ubiquity of smartphones and the viral capacity of Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and blogs were already bringing unprecedented accountability to police misconduct and government oppression, be it a Baltimore cop screaming obscenities at a kid on a skateboard, a transit cop in Oakland shooting a man who lay handcuffed on his stomach, or government paramilitaries in Iran gunning down a young woman in cold blood during Arab Spring democracy protests. But the occupiers, who tended to be young, white, and middle to upper middle class, knew social media like few other demographics. They knew how to live stream video directly to the internet. They all had smartphones, so police couldn't suppress incriminating video by confiscating one or two or 10 phones. Someone was bound to have video of not only the original incident, but also of police trying to confiscate phones to cover it up. The political reaction to the Occupy crackdowns was interesting to watch. In the 1990s, it had been the right wing, particularly the far right, that was up in arms over police militarization. Recall the outrage on the right over Waco, Ruby Ridge, and the raid to seize Elian Gonzalez. The left had largely either remained silent or even defended the government's tactics in those cases. But the right-wing diatribes against jackbooted thugs and federal stormtroopers all died down once the Clinton administration left office, and they were virtually non-existent after September 11, 2001. By the time cops started cracking heads at the Occupy protests, some conservatives were downright gleeful. The militarization of federal law enforcement certainly didn't stop. But the 9/11 attacks and a friendly administration seemed to quell the conservatives' concerns. So long as law enforcement was targeting hippie protesters, undocumented immigrants, suspected drug offenders, and alleged terrorist sympathizers, they were back to being heroes. Stephen Greenhut, a conservative-leaning columnist for the Orange County Register and editor of the investigative journalism site Cal Watchdog, was dismayed by the right's reaction. What's really disgusting is the natural instinct of so many conservatives to stick up for the police, Greenhut wrote. They don't like the Occupy protesters, so they willingly back brutality against them, without considering the possibility that conservatives at some point might be on the receiving end of this aggression. Unfortunately, consistent voices like Greenhut's have been rare. Partisan reaction to aggressive police actions against opponents tends to fall somewhere between indifference and Schadenfreude. After the December 2012 shooting massacre in Newtown, Connecticut put the issue of gun control back into the political discourse, some progressives again dredged up the right's criticism of the ATF in the early 1990s. In one lengthy segment, MSNBC host Rachel Maddow aired old footage from Waco and Ruby Ridge while making some tenuous connections between gun rights politicians and activists and Weaver, McVeigh, and Koresh. She referred to a conspiracy-driven corner of the gun world's paranoia about federal agents, without paying much heed to the fact that the ATF was inflicting the same sort of abuse on suspected gun offenders that Maddow herself has decried when used against suspected undocumented immigrants or Occupy protesters. More tellingly, Maddow added that there's nothing wrong with wanting to give more power to the ATF based only on the politics of the people opposed to doing so. Sometimes the character of the opposition defines why something ought to be the most politically viable thing in the world, she said. But even before Newtown, progressives have been advocating for the use of more government force against political factions they find unsavory. In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security issued a controversial report on what the author, DHS analyst Daryl Johnson, called a resurgence of right-wing extremism and the threat it posed to domestic security. The report was widely criticized on the right and was eventually criticized and revoked by DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano. But after a spate of mass killings in the following years by assailants with political views that in some cases could loosely be characterized as right-wing, Johnson became something of a progressive hero. Most of the incidents involved clearly mentally ill attackers whose politics were all over the place. Even Johnson acknowledged that the incident most in line with his thesis, the massacre at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, by a white supremacist named Wade Michael Page, was the work of a lone wolf attacker, and likely would not have been prevented by the recommendations in his report. Still, he was celebrated on the left. The progressive advocacy group Media Matters declared him vindicated. Similar sentiment popped up on progressive outlets like Think Progress, Salon, Rachel Maddow's MSNBC blog, and Democracy Now! In truth, attacks by groups on the fringes of the right wing have actually dropped in recent years, despite some claims that they've increased in response to the election of a black president. Attacks from groups on the fringes of the left wing are in decline, too, as are alleged attempted terrorist attacks by fringe Muslim groups. In a 2012 interview with the Idaho Spokesman Review, Johnson showed why it may not have been such a great idea for progressives to embrace him simply because he wanted to shut down opinions they found distasteful. Johnson was interviewed for an article on the 20th anniversary of the Ruby Ridge fiasco, and he took one step further, Rachel Maddow's idea of supporting government force simply because you don't like the factions opposing it. Johnson, in fact, suggested that merely having concerns about police militarization is a worry only borne by extremists. In fact, he appeared to have suggested that even recognizing that militarization is happening is an indication of fringe extremism. For American extremists, the siege at Ruby Ridge symbolizes the militarized police state, said Johnson. The U.S. government, through its Department of Homeland Security in particular, he said, has unintentionally fostered and even solidified Orwellian conspiracies concerning an overzealous, oppressive federal government and its perceived willingness to kill to ensure citizen compliance. In the minds of modern-day extremists, homeland security has enhanced the lethal capacity of many underfunded small-town police forces through its grant programs. Using federal grants, state and local law enforcement agencies have been able to buy expensive equipment and training that are commonly associated with the military, he said, adding that extremists view such a security buildup as a continuation of the Ruby Ridge legacy. That legacy is a continuing drumbeat for extremists and white supremacists who recruit with the message of big government versus the little guy and the government set me up. These extremist ideas continue as messages and even recruiting themes among various radical groups in the United States, Johnson said. I attempted to contact Johnson to ask if he'd like to clarify his comments. He didn't return my calls. As they stand, these quotes are striking, particularly from someone who once worked for the Department of Homeland Security and now runs a consulting firm that works with law enforcement agencies. They certainly appear to dismiss police militarization, a phenomenon documented by a wide range of media outlets and criticized by interests all across the political spectrum, as merely a fantasy cooked up by extremists to boost their recruiting. Incidentally, the publications and advocacy groups who have recently expressed concerns about police militarization include Think Progress, Wired, Salon, MSNBC, and Democracy Now. All of them also ran articles praising Johnson. So long as partisans are only willing to speak out against aggressive, militarized police tactics when they're used against their own, and are dismissive or even supportive of such tactics when used against those whose politics they dislike, it seems unlikely that the country will achieve enough of a political consensus to begin to slow down the trend. Just as with Bill Clinton, there was hope among progressives that Barack Obama would take a more conciliatory, less militaristic approach to the drug war. And just as with Bill Clinton, Obama has come up short. According to a tally by Current TV, by the end of his first term, Obama had overseen more federal raids on medical marijuana dispensaries in 4 years than George W. Bush had presided over in 8. Obama also stepped up immigration raids and continued the raids on doctors and pain clinics suspected of overprescribing opioids. He continued to encourage Mexico's policy, aided by U.S. foreign aid and weapons, of fighting its drug war with the military, despite the horrifying carnage caused by that policy. And as previously discussed, Obama and Democratic leaders in Congress refunded the Byrne Grant and COPS programs that contributed to the rise in SWAT teams and multi-jurisdictional anti-drug and anti-gang task forces, and at record levels. The 1033 program had also soared to new heights under Obama. In its October 2011 newsletter, which carries the revealing tagline, "From Warfighter to Crime Fighter," the Law Enforcement Support Office, LESO, the agency that oversees the Pentagon giveaways, boasted that fiscal year 2011 was the most productive in its history, by a lot. FY11 has been a historic year for the program, wrote LESO program manager Craig Barrett. We reutilized more than $500 million, that is million with an M, worth of property in FY11. This passes the previous mark by several hundred million dollars. $500 million in reutilization was a monumental achievement in FY11, but I believe we can exceed that in FY12. The take in 2011 alone was equivalent to about 18% of the total value of the equipment the program had given away in its history. In fiscal year 2011, the program gave away 800 Humvees, a 700% increase over 2010. In Los Angeles County, the Sheriff's Department put 4 semi-trailers on standby so that, as a new piece of desirable war gear became available, the department could be en route to pick it up before another police department could claim it. The investigative journalism site California Watch reported that, by 2011, The department was taking in $3 million to $4 million worth of military gear annually, including M16 rifles, helicopters, microwaves, survival kits, workout equipment, bayonet knives, and ammunition cans. During the record year for 1033 in the state as a whole, California police agencies raked in over 163,000 total items in 2011, worth over $26 million, from bath mats acquired by the sheriff of Sonoma County to a full-tracked tank for rural San Joaquin County. Police in San Joaquin County had already purchased a $500,000 armored mobile command center with a DHS grant. California Watch reported that in Rio Dell, a small Humboldt County town with just 4 full-time officers, not including the chief, the police department has used the program to pick up 2 vehicles and 2 M16 rifles. In Richland County, South Carolina, Sheriff Leon Lott was so pleased with his new acquisition that he posed with it, along with his SWAT team, and then put out a press release. He called it the Peacemaker, explaining in his release that the Bible refers to law enforcement in Matthew chapter 5, verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. The Peacemaker is an M113A1 armored personnel carrier. The vehicle moves on tank-like tracks and features a belt-fed turreted machine gun that fires 50-caliber rounds. Richland County includes the city of Columbia and its northern suburbs. It's also home to the University of South Carolina. What it isn't is a battlefield. According to Charles Earl Barnett, a U.S. Marine veteran and retired police officer who has served on several United Nations and NATO military and peacekeeping missions, a 50-caliber machine gun is completely inappropriate for domestic police work. It causes mass death and destruction, Barnett told me in 2008. It's indiscriminate. I can't think of a possible scenario where it would be appropriate. But Richland County isn't the only jurisdiction that can fire off rounds of that size. Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County, Arizona, also has a gun that shoots 50-caliber ammunition. So does Chattanooga, Tennessee, Anne Arundel County, Maryland, and Cuyahoga County, Ohio. In Bossier Parish, Louisiana, the 50-caliber gun is mounted to an armored vehicle that the sheriff calls his war wagon. At least after the sheriff's department in Faulkner County, Arkansas, used nearly $12,000 in asset forfeiture funds to purchase a 50-caliber gun, they had the good sense to decide they shouldn't use it. It shoots through buildings, Sheriff Carl Byrd told a local newspaper. There is absolutely no legitimate law enforcement use of this rifle. There have been at least a few other voices of sanity. In Massachusetts, Governor Deval Patrick ordered the state's police agencies to stop using the program pending an investigation after a Boston Globe report found, well, basically what similar investigations all over the country had found, from the Globe. Police in Wellfleet, a community known for stunning beaches and succulent oysters, scored 3 military assault rifles. At Salem State College, where recent police calls have included false fire alarms and a goat roaming the campus, school police got 2 M16s. In West Springfield, police acquired even more powerful weaponry, 2 military-issue M79 grenade launchers. In June 2012, the Pentagon suspended the entire 1033 program, not because of any concern about the militarization of civilian policing, but because of recent press reports of mismanagement by some of the participating law enforcement agencies. An Arizona Republic investigation had found that the Pinal County Sheriff's Department transferred some of the Pentagon equipment to non-police agencies and was planning to sell some other equipment at auction. A broader AP report found that police departments had kept poor records about their use of the equipment obtained through the program, including high-powered weapons that could no longer be accounted for. As of November 2012, however, the program was back up and running. Finally, the Obama administration has continued to defend in court the use of military-like violence to enforce the drug laws. In Avena v. U.S., DEA agents pointed their guns at an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old during a mistaken drug raid. The agents had apparently misidentified the license plate of a suspected drug trafficker for the plate on a car owned by Thomas Avina, the father of the children. The Obama administration argued in federal court that the lawsuit should be dismissed before even being heard by a jury, that the agents' actions were reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Of course, it's not at all unusual for an administration to defend the actions of federal drug agents. But this was an administration whose drug czar had suggested that perhaps it was time to tone down the battle rhetoric that government officials often used when enforcing the drug laws. He was right about that. But on the front lines, the administration was arguing in court that there's nothing unreasonable about government agents pointing guns at the heads of children whose parents are suspected of drug crimes, and that even when said gun pointing is done in the service of a mistaken raid, the agents should be shielded from any liability. There's always a good time to use a taser. So said Andrea, an attractive single mom and one of the four stars of the TLC reality show The Police Women of Broward County, which debuted in 2009. In the trailer that included the taser quip, the video then cut to the show's stars tackling suspects, slamming knees into kidneys, pointing guns, and generally kicking ass. Judging from other clips on the TLC website, some of which featured shots of the female officers in bikinis, it seemed that the network couldn't make up its mind whether these women were sex pots with handcuffs or girl cops who were just as rough and tough as the boys. A poster ad campaign for the show only reinforced the identity crisis. One read, "Taser time." Another, "Cavity search, anyone?" Pop culture has always had a big influence on police culture, sometimes reflecting prevailing sentiment and sometimes driving it. In his chronicle of the 1970s, How We Got Here, conservative pundit David Frum argues that the decade's parade of renegade cops who skirt the law but still abide by a familiar moral code, think Dirty Harry, reflected the prevailing opinion at the time that bad court decisions and criminal coddling procedures were preventing well-meaning cops from getting the bad guys. Ed Burns, the former narcotics cop and co-creator of HBO's The Wire, thinks the influence might have been the other way around. In a 2008 interview, Burns said that the Gene Hackman movie The French Connection had a big influence on the culture of drug cops. In The French Connection, Detective Popeye Doyle had this very cynical, harsh, rough, law-breaking type of drug style that sort of set the tone in how street narcotics guys work, very flippant. What the movie didn't pick up, and what you didn't see, is all the intense surveillance and hard work that would go into a drug bust back then. But they put out the idea of this guy who cracks heads, especially in that scene they went and they shook the bar down. That became iconic. And that is the way the cops were afterward. I mean, you'd see white cops in black neighborhoods looking like Serpico. And they're not undercover. It was just this mindset that took over of how you're supposed to dress and act and the way you're supposed to be. The French Connection, it's worth noting, came out in 1971. The series of botched Odale raids in Collinsville and elsewhere began in 1973. In the 1980s, the TV show Miami Vice nurtured the belief that South Florida was teeming with drug lords armed with more guns than most third world armies, while Hill Street Blues offered the grittiest, most realistic portrayal of a big city police department yet aired on television. The show cast most of its cops in a sympathetic light, but also took on issues like racism, corruption, and brutality. For the better part of a generation, the Fox hit Cops was the only reality police show on TV. For 20 years, America watched as patient patrol officers broke up domestic disputes, arrested sunburned wife beaters, and chased petty drug offenders down darkened alleys. Though the departments depicted in the show always had veto power over the footage that made it on the air, Cops generally did well to depict the monotonies of police work, be it walking a beat, calmly talking down a jealous husband, or driving a long all-night neighborhood patrol in a squad car. It was really the expansion of cable TV in the 1990s and 2000s that blew out the cop reality genre with shows that tended to emphasize confrontation and celebrate a culture of police militarism. A&E broke in first with Dallas SWAT, which sent a camera crew with the city's elite paramilitary police unit to document drug raids and standoffs. The show's success spawned Detroit SWAT and Kansas City SWAT. Court TV then jumped in with Texas SWAT and SWAT USA. Testosterone-infused Spike TV joined the mix in 2008 with DEA. Produced by jolly weatherman-come-drug warrior Al Roker, the first season followed a group of federal agents. Also in Detroit, the city's crumbling badlands provide great backdrop for reality shows. As they planned and carried out drug raids, it also produced an unintentionally hilarious moment when self-proclaimed pot smoker and legalization advocate Joe Rogan was forced to conduct a reverent promotional interview with one of the show's drug agent stars while hosting one of Spike's mixed martial arts events. The obvious criticism of such shows is their exploitation and general tackiness. Not that anyone expects much dignity from most of the cable networks, but you'd think, for example, that the Broward County Sheriff's Department might object to the sexualization of its female officers, or to a national ad campaign insinuating that they're sporting itchy taser fingers. But those shows may have a more sinister effect. In emphasizing the more aggressive, confrontational aspect of police work over community service, hurting people instead of helping people, they may be shifting the profile of the typical young person attracted to police work. Browse the dozens of police recruitment videos on YouTube, for example, and you'll find that many of them feature images of cops tackling suspects, rappelling out of helicopters, shooting guns, kicking down doors, and sicking dogs on people. The images are often set to blaring guitars or heavy metal music. These are the videos that police departments send to high schools and colleges to attract new recruits. At the very first step in the process of staffing their departments, then, these agencies are deliberately appealing to people who are likely to be lured by the thrill-seeking, adrenaline-producing, butt-kicking aspects of law enforcement. Build an entire police force of people who fit that description, and you have a force of cops who seek confrontation instead of avoiding it, and who look to escalate volatile situations instead of resolving them peacefully. These are the sort of cops who volunteer for the SWAT team for the very reasons they should be excluded from it. Cops like the two Maricopa County SWAT officers who talked to CBS News reporter Jim Stewart in 1997. The best part of being on the SWAT team, one of the officers said, was that you get to play with a lot of guns. That's what's fun. You know, everybody on this team is, you know, loves guns. The second cop then chimed in, "Hey, the bottom line is, it's friggin' fun, man. That's the deal. Nobody wants to take burglary reports." Even the wrong door raid has become well established in pop culture. The first depiction of one I could find on network television was in a 1990 episode of the NBC drama L.A. Law. But it's become more common in the last decade or so. In one episode of The Simpsons, Chief Wiggum mistakenly raids the home of Reverend Lovejoy in search of a cattle rustler. The shot then pans down the street to show loose cattle grazing in the front yard of Springfield's well-known career criminal. One particularly pointed skit on Comedy Central's Chappelle's Show depicted the discrepancy between police raids on white people suspected of white-collar crimes and black people suspected of drug crimes. In the skit, a white CEO is subjected to a drug raid in which the cops set off a flash grenade, shoot the man's dog, sexually assault his wife, and beat him as they yell at him to stop resisting. Coming full circle, in 2009, a viral video posing as an ad for a search engine parodied the SWAT reality shows by following Fresno SWAT as they mistakenly raid a daycare center, a family eating dinner, and an elderly couple. It ends with the statement, "Imagine if Dispatch gave out as much bad information as search engines do." And so here we are. The wrong door raid has now been normalized to the point where it can be parodied in a viral internet commercial for a search engine. The numbers. Number of drug raids in New York City in 1994, 1,447. In 1997, 2,977. In 2002, 5,117. Approximate number of raids each year by the Toledo, Ohio SWAT team, as of 2008, 400. Percentage of towns between 25,000 and 50,000 people with a SWAT team in 1984, 25.6%. In 1990, 52.1%. In 2005, 80%. Approximate number of SWAT raids in the United States in 1995, 30,000. In 2001, 45,000. In 2005, 50,000 to 60,000. Total number of federal agencies employing law enforcement personnel in 1996, 53. In 2008, 73. Total number of federal law enforcement officers as of 1996, 74,500, 28 per 100,000 citizens. In 2008, 120,000, 40 per 100,000 citizens. Number of SWAT teams in the FBI alone in 2013, 56. Unlikely federal agencies with SWAT teams. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Consumer Protection Safety Commission, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, Department of Education, Department of Health and Human Services, U.S. National Park Service, Food and Drug Administration. Value of surplus military gear received by Johnston, Rhode Island, from the Pentagon in 2010 to 2011, $4.1 million. Population of Johnston, Rhode Island in 2010, 28,769. Partial list of equipment given to the Johnston Police Department. 30 M16 rifles. 599 M16 magazines containing about 18,000 rounds. A sniper targeting calculator. 44 bayonets, 12 Humvees, and 23 snowblowers. Chapter 9. Reform. There is no crueler tyranny than that which is perpetuated under the shield of law and in the name of justice. Charles de Montesquieu. Shy Calvo, only intended to